From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Florida politics, the vote recount, the misleading ballot, and Governor Jeb Bush. We talk with journalist S.V. Date, who's in Tallahassee, where he's bureau chief for the Palm Beach Post. Also, literary sleuth Don Foster. His forensic methods unmask Joe Klein as the anonymous author of Primary Colors. His latest project, Who Really Wrote The Night Before Christmas. Plus, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the election night coverage. It's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Florida officials say George W. Bush's lead over Al Gore in the presidential race stood at more than 1,700 votes this afternoon, with 53 of 67 counties reporting. That number was considerably larger than an unofficial figure the Associated Press released earlier. At a news conference this evening, Florida's Agriculture Commissioner Bob Crawford urged a nation waiting for the results of its presidential election to stay calm and respect the democratic process.
I know a lot of people in this country are watching Florida right now, and I want people to know that while there's a lot of frustration surrounding this election, nobody ever said that democracy is simple or efficient. But this is democracy in action.
And Florida officials said that even after all 67 counties report, results will not be certified until at least November 17th, while overseas ballots are tabulated. The Bush campaign blasted the Gore camp's assertion earlier today that tainted votes for Al Gore were suppressed in Florida. NPR's John Burnett reports from Austin.
Bush campaign officials attempted to counter the Democrats' contention that faulty ballots in Palm Beach County may have lost thousands of legitimate votes for Al Gore. Bush's campaign manager Don Evans explained that while it's true 19,000 ballots were invalidated in that county because of double voting, he said it's not that unusual because a large number of ballots were also invalidated in Palm Beach County in 1996.
The Democrats who are politicizing and distorting these events risk doing so at the expense of our democracy.
Bush's press secretary said the governor remains calm and upbeat today, and the campaign is confident the results of the Florida recount will affirm his razor-thin victory over the vice president. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
The Labor Department reports the Producer Price Index, which measures prices of finished goods before they reach consumers, rose 0.4% last month. But taking food and energy out of the mix, prices were actually slightly lower in October, as NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The government numbers showing moderating price pressures in October seem to be more evidence the Federal Reserve Board policies designed to slow economic growth and prevent an uptick in inflation are working. While prices for some goods increased last month, in many cases they were up only modestly. Energy prices, which have been sharply higher lately, showed signs of easing. That was primarily due to a nearly 2% drop in the wholesale cost of gasoline. Computer costs also fell, and end-of-year incentives by manufacturers helped push new car prices down 1.8%. But higher prices for food and prescription drugs still contributed to an overall rise in the index. Taking out food and energy, however, the so-called core rate was down 0.1%. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Industrials closed down 73 points today at 10,834. The Nasdaq was down 31 at 3,200. This is NPR News. The suspense in the U.S. presidential election has received banner headline coverage in the world press. From London, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
An air of amazement dominates the front pages and editorials over the U.S. presidential contest that hangs in suspension. The British Guardian wondered if it was time for the United States to change the way it elects its president, calling the Electoral College an anachronistic mechanism. The Mirror calls America a laughingstock, while the Express hails the vote as democracy at its best. Spain's El País says, but for the 3% polled by Ralph Nader, Al Gore would have been the clear winner. Russia's Izvestia quotes observers as saying that a Bush victory would not be the worst option for Moscow. And the Hindustan Times writes that the first U.S. poll of the millennium gave no party, no ideology, and no personality a mandate. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
Jean Carnahan, the widow of the late Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, said today she's ready to assume the Senate seat her late husband won. Carnahan died in a plane crash prior to the election. His successor as governor, Roger Wilson, has said he will appoint Mrs. Carnahan to a 2-year Senate term in place of her husband. The Federal Trade Commission today voted unanimously to delay action on America Online's proposed acquisition of Time Warner for up to 3 weeks. The FTC said it wants the companies to propose ways to solve antitrust problems with the $127 billion deal. The FTC said the two companies have agreed to offer new proposals to address what the agency has called competitive issues. A source close to the situation says they involve cable access. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. The political picture could not be any stranger. 2 days after the election, we still don't know the winner of the presidential race. Stranger still is that the decisive tally will come from Florida, where the chief executive is the brother of one of the candidates. Former secretaries of state lead the legions of lawyers both camps have dispatched to Tallahassee, and at this point, it's unclear exactly when and how all of this is going to be resolved. S.V. Date is in perfect position to observe this drama. He's the Tallahassee bureau chief of the Palm Beach Post and a novelist. His latest book is Smokeout, a comedic thriller about Florida politics and the tobacco lobby, a story that, until Tuesday night, seemed pretty hard to top. Earlier today, I asked him to tell us more about the area at the heart of the current controversy.
Palm Beach County is it's diverse. I mean, we're a large county, one of the largest, certainly in South Florida, we're easily the biggest one. But in terms of our main population centers, the southern part of our county is very much like Broward County. A lot of elderly people, a lot of elderly Jewish people who live in these condominiums, and they have their polling places right there, and it's a Democratic stronghold. When Governor Lawton Childs ran in 1994, it was South Florida. It was Palm Beach, Dade, and Broward counties that pulled him through. I mean, were it not for those counties, he would have lost by several hundred thousand votes. Same thing again the other night. Perhaps people from the other parts of the country were looking in and saying, you know, well, Gore's down 150,000 votes with 80% counted, 85% counted. There's no way he's going to pull it out. Well, yeah, he is. You have to count Broward and Dade and Palm Beach, and those are going to be going to for Gore 67, 70, 75%. Sure enough, that's what happened. Now, what's interesting is Broward County voted for Buchanan at a rate of 0.14%. Mm-hmm. Statewide, Buchanan got 0.29% of the vote. In Palm Beach County, Buchanan got 0.79% of the vote, and there's just absolutely no explaining that whatsoever. You're not going to find a lot of support for Pat Buchanan and his ideas in an elderly retirement community made up of primarily Jewish people. It's not going to happen, and yet there were his strong support. Clearly, this is a mistake. This is not what they wanted to do when they went into that ballot booth.
There's still a question whether, oops, I did it wrong, is grounds for reversing an election, though.
That's certainly true. You know, the instructions were there. If you read them carefully, you would see that you have to follow the arrow from the name to the hole, and you press the hole. Now, in elections past, we didn't face this issue because you never had 10 parties or 10 tickets running for president in Florida. We recently, in 1998, we had a constitutional amendment that was approved by the voters, which changed the ballot access laws. It became much easier for a minor party to get on the ballot. So this year, for the first time, we had 10 tickets. And because of that, the election supervisors around the state were faced with the dilemma of, okay, how do we do this? We can keep it clean and simple by listing all 10 names in a row, or we can try to make it large type, user-friendly, and spread them over 2 pages. Palm Beach County was the only county, as far as I know, that did the latter. We used larger print, but then we had a confusing system where you really had to follow the arrow from the name to the proper hole. Now, I can understand the rationale of somebody thinking, well, I don't know if I got the card in here properly. Perhaps I should count holes to make sure. And when you count holes, you get it wrong. And that seems to, I mean, it's just not my theorizing. This is what people who've called in by the hundreds have said they did.
Those people who were involved in the situation where they think they may have voted incorrectly for Pat Buchanan instead of the candidate they wanted to vote for, there are apparently some of them who say that they wanted to change their ballot while they were in the polling place, but were not permitted to do so.
Well, my understanding is that they should have been allowed to do so. I believe that in these situations where you have a immutable ballot, in the sense that once you mark it or once you poke a hole in it, it forever alters that piece of paper, my understanding is that you should be given an opportunity to start afresh at least twice. I believe it's three times, but at least twice after your first try. We were getting dozens of these phone calls the very afternoon that it was happening in real time. So this is, I mean, what I hope to give the impression here is that we had an indication that there were serious problems the day that it was going on, mm-hmm. when we didn't know, when we had no idea what the result was going to be and that it was going to hinge entirely upon those votes. In fact, the reason that it became such a huge story for us, some of our editors made these mistakes and realized that if they were doing it, probably others were. And we wrote that story that very day, that there were some serious issues with the balloting in Palm Beach County.
We are familiar with stories, going back certainly to the 1960 election, of irregularities in places like Illinois and Chicago and Cook County. Is there a history of voter shenanigans in the state of Florida?
Well, let's put it this way. As late as 1997, we had to throw out an entire mayoral race in the city of Miami because invented people, dead people, people who've lived nowhere near Miami, somehow were voting in that election. And it was not a one or two or three thing. That led to some changes in the absentee ballot rules and so forth in the next legislative session. But, you know, the funny thing is, usually the types of irregularities, apart from the Palm Beach issue, those are large numbers there. But typically when people complain about, oh, I was intimidated from going to the polls, or they didn't let me vote even though I was registered, we're talking an extremely small number of people spread over an entire state. And usually the final tally is so conclusive in its result, the numbers are so far apart between candidates, that even if every one of those people who were complaining about something were correct, it wouldn't make a difference. Here, literally, every vote is making a difference. That's the difference.
The governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, was, a lot of people think, and you've certainly written, was originally the son of the Bush family who was expected to run for president. How did it work out that we got George W.?
I think a lot of people are wondering that. I think if it happens that Gore ends up winning this, many more people are going to be wondering that. Look at their histories. Jeb Bush whizzed through college in 2.5 years. He then went and became a banker in Venezuela, lived overseas for a time, came back to work on his dad's campaign. He's been working hard all his life. He brings these habits with him to Tallahassee. He's a workaholic. Now, you know, like his policies, dislike his policies, whatever, you cannot say that he's not a articulate, smart, extremely hardworking individual. Now, we in Florida don't know George W. Bush terribly well. We've seen him for the last few months. And frankly, when the two are on stage together at the same time, the comparison is very obvious and the distinction is very clear. And so we have a situation where we have Jeb Bush, who we did elect to governor. Now, keep in mind, Florida, we have a relatively weak governor, and we were still a little bit, not nervous, but maybe had some potential misgivings about electing Jeb, who'd never had elected office before, to the highest job in the state. Now, here he is, who's a guy who's obviously more capable than his brother, and he's asking us to make his brother the leader of the free world. That's something That's a bit much to ask, and obviously some people said no, which is why the election's as close as it is. Everyone expected in the Republican Party that Jeb would solidly lock down Florida and deliver it without much of a fight at all. You know, the fact that we're counting votes 2 days after the election, you know, that didn't happen.
Is Jeb Bush a successful governor of Florida? I mean, you would think that if he was doing well and popular there, obviously popular enough to get elected, that it would be a cakewalk for him to shepherd his brother through to a presidential victory.
That was the theory. Jeb Bush's approval ratings are extremely high. He, most people who disagree with his policies still find him agreeable. At times, he can be a bit imperious, I guess. He's rubbed the legislature the wrong way many a time. But it didn't happen that his popularity rubbed off on his brother, and I think that goes back to the comparisons that are made. Jeb Bush will work until the late night hours understanding a problem. I've sent emails to him regarding stories I'm writing, and he sometimes answers back at 10 or 10:30 at night or as early as 6:30 in the morning. George Bush, by all accounts, doesn't like to keep those kind of work schedules. And, you can love your brother and do all you can for him, but at the end of the day, your brother's got to do stuff for himself. And I think that's what's happened in Florida.
Is there a sibling rivalry?
Oh, there must be. Jeb Bush is extremely competitive. He's known to play golf on Sunday afternoons, and he means to win, regardless of who he's playing with. And it's kind of a power golf where he briskly walks around the course, and it doesn't take him too terribly long. And he wants to play well, and he wants to beat whoever he's playing with. I can't imagine that there was that kind of competitiveness was not there between the brothers. Obviously, you know, we weren't there when they were growing up. Mm-hmm. But, I think of the day when George W. must have announced to his brother that he was going to run for president and what Jeb's reaction must have been. He must have kind of suck it all up and put out his hand and give him a hug and say, you know, I'm gonna make it happen for you and I'm going to deliver Florida and so forth. And you got to wonder, in the deepest recesses of his mind, he must know that if his brother runs for president, he probably may never get the opportunity to do so at that point. And yet, what do you say when your brother wants to do something that's ambitious and a dream of many people? You obviously have to support him. I mean, Jeb Bush is in a very tough position here, personally and professionally.
My guest is reporter and novelist S.V. Sharish Date. He's the Tallahassee bureau chief of the Palm Beach Post. His latest novel is Smoke Out. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Sharish Date of the Palm Beach Post. His latest novel is Smoke Out. This book is, as they say, loosely based on a real incident, a real story in the state of Florida when Lawton Chiles got a bill through the state legislature that made it easier to sue tobacco companies.
Right. What happened was in 1994, Governor Chiles succeeded in sneaking through. And that's how the Florida legislature works, by the way, for those of you unfamiliar with it. Most of the things that we come to read about as being very bad laws or very dramatic laws are snuck through. People don't talk about them in the open. They're usually little amendments, little changes to existing laws that have dramatic results. What happened in 94 was Chiles was able to sneak through in the closing hours of the legislative session a bill that basically made it very, very easy for him to sue Big Tobacco. Now, when tobacco figured this out within days, they got extremely upset. In 1995, the legislature, repealed that law. Governor Childs vetoed that repeal. So back it came back in 1996 with the legislature about to override Governor Childs's veto, if you followed that.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, now the legislature needs 2/3 vote in each chamber in order to do what tobacco wanted. They had the votes in the House, no problem. The Senate was going to be close. Everybody knew it. It was going to be 27 votes. One of those votes was a woman named Ginny Brown Waite. She's a state senator from the western part of Florida, Crystal River. And she'd always voted with tobacco on the argument that, you know, no one makes you smoke. If you want to quit, you can quit. And it's an individual decision. Tobacco ought not be held accountable for your own flaws. Childs did an interesting thing. He was able to provide her with some documents, with some material that his trial team by this point had already found regarding tobacco and what they'd done over the years and the tactics they'd used and so forth. And he knew that Senator Brown Waite was a very likely, very receptive person to get this material. Her father, her mother, and her younger sister had passed away from smoking-related diseases. She says later now, she stayed up all night. She couldn't sleep that night reading this stuff and trying to decide what to do. And she gave a dramatic, emotional speech to a silent Senate chamber the next day and said, you know, I can't play the tobacco game any longer. This has gone on too long, and I'm going to vote to sustain the veto. So it was that they lost by one vote. Now, rarely in real life does an entire issue, does a whole giant story like that boil down and crystallize itself in a single moment, and it did in Florida on the Senate floor in March of 1996. And at that time, I thought, whoa, this is huge. Mm. If this stands, this will be enormous in years to come. And sure enough, it has. We had a settlement in Florida, $13 billion in a year and a half. And then just recently, we had a verdict in Miami, which is not a structured settlement. We had jurors who got so tired of tobacco and what they had been doing over the years that said, you know, pay up, $145 billion. We want it now. We want to see it. So I think it's very, very plausible that none of this happens, none of it, had it not been for that one vote in Florida. That's just, to me, just amazing. In years to come, people will write history and look at that. I didn't want to write history. I wanted to take that moment and kind of play with it and use it to get into how Tallahassee works.
Describing how Tallahassee works and the interaction between senators, state senators, and lobbyists. State senators in Florida, in your novel, and I assume this is correct, you say they make $25,000 a year?
That's right. We have what we like to call a citizen legislature, in which folks are expected to have regular average jobs, or not average, as the case may be, and then come up to Tallahassee for 2 months and discuss the issues of the day and then go home and resume their everyday lives. Now, way too often this does not happen. They become essentially professional politicians. They spend the better part of their day, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, to deal with constituents and so forth. But because there are institutional reasons why they don't want to give themselves a pay raise, certainly, and they don't want to make themselves a professional legislature either, what ends up happening is for far too many, they rely almost exclusively on the lobbyists and the staff for most of their decision-making, for most of their knowledge about issues. Now, another part of this is some people, after they get elected to the legislature, figure out a way to make themselves rich merely by being in the legislature. And I can't tell you how many legislators have consultancy jobs. And what they do is they consult with local governments, presumably about their expertise in governmental affairs. Well, in some cases, we have chairs of appropriations committees. And they're going around and talking to local governments and planning boards and whatnot and offering their expertise when everyone knows darn well that the expertise they're offering is that, hey, I'm chair of the committee that handles $45 billion a year, and if you want something for your little hometown, then you ought to do what my client wants here at the local level. Yeah, that's absurd. That is absurd that we're basically selling access to these people for no other reason that they're in the state legislature.
And these decisive bills often come down to just a word or two in a rider, an amendment.
Absolutely. And again, the amendments are written by the lobbyists. It's stunning. I mean, if people saw how things work up here, they would be appalled. Mm. Who is it? Kaiser Wilhelm, I guess, said you don't want it. There are two things in life you don't want to be seen being made, is sausage and legislation. Well, the legislation might even be worse here in Tallahassee. It's especially toward the end of session when things are frenzied. You have we have a large open area between the two legislative chambers. It's called the Rotunda. It is packed with lobbyists. And what they do is they send in notes to the legislators to ask them to come out for a moment. The legislator comes out. The lobbyist hands him an amendment. And the little legislator goes back in and introduces it. And that's how it works. And you can have major dramatic changes to bills for these handwritten notes that are given to the lawmakers by people who are paid by interest groups to do these things. We had a bill that was supposed to honor a Florida State trooper who was killed in the line of duty, and it made some changes to the drunk driving laws to make it more difficult for people to get away with vehicular manslaughter, something to that effect. And the bail bondsman lobby was able to change it basically to enrich themselves, to add a word here and a word there. Governor Bush ended up vetoing it because it was so outrageous. Now, these are the sort of things that happen, and unfortunately, the one though that I just described, that's one of the few that we actually find out about.
You've set one of your books, it was a murder mystery, a thriller, at NASA, and that was called Final Orbit. Then Speed Week was about Daytona. Again, murder played a prominent role in that, and the threat of death certainly lingers around your most recent book, Smokeout. After NASA, after Daytona, and now Tallahassee, what's next?
I guess I got to keep moving on to new beats to find new things to write about in my fiction. What's next is Central Florida. I used to work for the Orlando Sentinel in Orlando, and it's amazing how much influence the theme park industries down there have over not just Central Florida but all of Florida. Walt Disney World, for an example, has its own special law in Florida. It's essentially allowed to govern itself on its land. It was given this right in the mid-60s by the Florida legislature. If they wanted, they could build their own nuclear power plant or airport on Disney property, you know, without anyone's having to question them about it. You know, obviously a situation like that offers a little bit of opportunity to have fun with it, especially if things start going awry on a fictional Central Florida theme parks property, and they are in charge of investigating and regulating it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
S.V. Date is Tallahassee bureau chief of the Palm Beach Post. His latest novel is Smokeout. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Learning Network, providing online learning tools and development programs for parents, teachers, and students. On the web at learningnetwork.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Unmasking Joe Klein. Literary forensic expert Don Foster tells us how he discovered the identity of the once anonymous author of Primary Colors. And David Bianculli reviews the election night TV coverage. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. Science is unraveling the cloak of anonymity. We now know that each of us leaves an indelible trail of evidence that leads unerringly to ourselves. Unique markers include fingerprints, DNA, retinal patterns, and, if you believe Don Foster, our words. Don Foster is a professor of English literature at Vassar College. A technique he developed identified William Shakespeare as the author of a previously unidentified poem that brought him controversy and celebrity, and they, in turn, brought him a series of more modern literary mysteries, from the Unabomber to The Night Before Christmas. Don Foster says, "We are what we read. Give anonymous offenders enough verbal rope and column inches, and they will hang themselves for you every time." Professor Foster has assembled a casebook titled Author Unknown on the Trail of Anonymous, and he joins us from New York. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be with you.
You write that the unlikely path from Shakespeare to literary forensics turned on a misprint?
Well, as a graduate student at the University of California some years ago, I was researching an old literary conundrum, Master W.H., to whom Shakespeare's sonnets are dedicated, and had to look at everything published by the stationer who published that document, and found another text by a W.S., common initials, but who nevertheless seemed to know his Shakespeare pretty well, and that put me on an entirely different tack of research.
Well, W.H. is sort of the grassy knoll of Shakespearean scholarship that has led to any number of theories ranging that Shakespeare's work were in fact written by Francis Bacon to Queen Elizabeth.
Whole libraries have been written on the question of who was W.H. Was he the young man to whom many of the sonnets are addressed? Was he the person who gave Thomas Thorpe, the publisher, a manuscript copy? And what my own research suggested by looking at other pamphlets and books of the time is that it's a simple misprint, that the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Master W.H., was probably intended to be to the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Master W.S.H., i.e. Shakespeare himself, the man who wrote them.
Thereby going back to one of the rules of thumb of conspiracy theories, never rule out stupidity.
Yeah, in this case, the simple misprint seemed to have generated more literary commentary than perhaps the sonnets themselves.
But then you went on to this other work, W.S., and this was a funeral elegy that turned out to be a murder mystery of its own.
Yes, this is a poem that hadn't received any critical or scholarly attention prior to my looking at it, and it's easy to see why. On a first reading, it's long and very long, not eminently Shakespearean. It's not Shakespeare as you like it, but it's from the first page registers its acquaintance with Shakespeare's manner. The dedication is modeled on Shakespeare's Rape of Lucrece, and as I began reading this poem back in 1984, I was struck by just how much Shakespeare was in it, and yet Shakespeare scholars had never discussed it.
How did you then go about finding a technique, literary forensics? Is this something that pre-existed your research?
I sometimes see myself credited as the inventor of a new science, which is giving me more credit than I deserve. As early as the Lindbergh kidnapping, this kind of work was being performed by scholars for police and FBI and other investigators. The police detectives themselves had to do some of this kind of work. And in literary studies, it's been a field of research at least as far as the medieval period.
Take us through the elements of language and grammar and punctuation. What of those things do you use to try to identify an author?
Well, as in a crime, no single line of a fingerprint would be decisive. No single bit of linguistic evidence should be described as a stylistic fingerprint, as a phrase that sometimes is used for this kind of work. It does take a pattern of evidence. So I begin just by assuming that nothing is irrelevant. I look at spelling, punctuation, diction, use and misuse of standard use and misuse of various words, the syntax, that is the way the sentences are put together, reading material that has contributed to the text. In the case of a funeral elegy, it included even, for example, some manuscript works that were known to be in possession of Shakespeare's dramatic company. And even in some cases where such information is available, the formatting on the printed page or typewritten page, the manner in which ideas are assembled and try to extract from the evidence a balanced case both for and against the possible suspects.
Was there one element that finally was the straw that broke this literary camel's back?
It was in 1995 that I finally was willing to say that the evidence seemed quite compelling that Shakespeare must be the author of this text, and some other scholars joined me in that conclusion. And so in January of 1996, I suddenly found the elegy for William Peter front page news in the New York Times.
But it was weight of evidence and no single smoking gun.
No, I'd say even today there's not a smoking gun. If it were absolutely conclusive, we would find, I guess you would say, universal consent among Shakespeare scholars. But there still have been a number of efforts to find someone else who might fit the bill. So far, no other candidate has emerged.
Not even Queen Elizabeth.
Well, it depends on whom you ask. Some will tell you that Queen Elizabeth or Francis Bacon or Christopher Marlowe not only wrote this poem, but Hamlet and King Lear.
Don Foster is my guest. He analyzes words, grammar, punctuation, and syntax to identify authors of anonymous material. He's written a book called Author Unknown. Your book is subtitled On the Trail of Anonymous, and that could be taken as a direct reference to one of the more celebrated cases that you've been involved in, and that is the author of Primary Colors, Anonymous.
Well, it was just when the New York Times featured its story on a funeral elegy that Random House released Primary Colors, and it shot straight to the top of the sales charts. So as I was fielding calls about a funeral elegy from press and news organizations around the world, suddenly I also began getting calls who wrote Primary Colors. Well, I hadn't read Primary Colors and didn't really think I could be of any help at all. But New York Magazine was persistent and kept calling back saying, we'd really like you to help us out here in identifying who is anonymous. And finally, I gave it the old college try.
That's a great philosophical question. Who is anonymous? But it was a specific question in this case. And it took you about a week.
Well, I couldn't have done it that quickly without help from the editors of New York Magazine, who kept sending me electronic text by possible suspects, Michael Kelly and Lisa Grunewald and Gary Trudeau and Christopher Buckley, one after another, whom I examined and had to rule out with some discouragement, finally thinking I wasn't going to find myself who wrote Primary Colors.
Listeners may not remember, but this was a cause célèbre at the time. It was a big controversy over who was the author of this book, and it was the best-selling book at the time.
Anonymous was a much bigger deal for many Washington reporters than Shakespeare, because after all, it had appeared that the book might have been written by a journalist, someone close to Clinton, and it became a wonderful guessing game. It was a very lively novel, and it seemed to be a roman en clef in which each of the characters, or at least each of the main characters, was either a politician or a pundit or someone on the inside track. So it was a tremendous hit with journalists, as with the public at large.
There was a Washington Post list of, I think it was 35 possible suspects, and I think they listed Joe Klein as 50 to 1. In the event, you found a strong clue as to the true identity of Anonymous in the very first line of the book.
Well, the Post's odds for Joe Klein were 50 to 1 against, so he's not someone that I looked at right away. When I began my work, I simply began looking for vocabulary. What other journalist, political novelist uses words that appear in Primary Colors, and began with the most unusual ones. It wasn't until near the end of my work, which is where I put this bit of evidence in my article as well, that I found what might be read as kind of a hidden self-disclosure in the opening lines of the book. The narrator of the novel is a black man, Henry Burton, and he tells his readers, "I am small and not so dark." And I thought I saw in that, after finding that Joe Klein was the likely author of Primary Colors, that it was kind of an in-joke. I am small. Klein is the German word for small. I am Klein, and I'm not really black.
Hmm. One of the problems, you write, is that when you're identifying long-dead poets, they're not going to stand up and deny their authorship.
Well, in this case, my suspect wasn't dead, and he did stand up and say, "It's not me. I didn't do it. This is silly."
And you were then excoriated and even subsequently had your own moments of doubt.
Well, it did take me back at first when Joe Klein went on national television and on CBS and in, again in Newsweek, his two employers backing him up, saying that he was not the author and that I had made a big mistake. And for the next 6 months, we're a little tense as Shakespeareans debated why they should believe Shakespeare wrote a rather dull funeral poem, if in fact I also said that Joe Klein had written Primary Colors and got that wrong.
And in fact, one of the reasons you had undertaken this project was to vindicate the techniques you had applied to Shakespeare.
Well, this was my idea. It didn't seem to be working out too well. It seemed in January and February and March of 1996 as if I had made a bad career move with that attribution.
Also, you seem to believe that Joe Klein, as a nationally prominent journalist, wouldn't flat out lie. And in fact, his sort of semi-denials of being the author before your article appeared in New York Magazine, those equivocations were one of the things that led you toward him or at least added to the body of evidence.
After coming to the conclusion that Joe Klein wrote Primary Colors, I had to look and see what, in fact, he had said on this subject, and the only denials I could find seemed pretty equivocal to me, which at least I took some reassurance in the thought that he wouldn't come out and say, "No, this is wrong." But in fact, that's how it turned out.
So when the press conference happened and Joe Klein came out and said, "I'm Joe Klein, and I am the author of Primary Colors," suddenly this 6 months that you had gone through of being challenged not only on your identification of Joe Klein, but on the whole Shakespearean issue before that, you were suddenly the most prominent literary attribution man on the planet.
Well, I had more or less ducked out of sight, not returning calls about this. I was a little weary of Primary Colors after 6 months of stressful consideration whether I ought to at least to have bit my tongue and not made the attribution. But other investigators, police and prosecutors, defenders, lawyers saw in the work that I had done a practical application for the work that they often do that had never really considered myself, which is that there are many anonymous and questioned documents out there in the real world that need an author as well.
My guest is Don Foster. His new book is Author Unknown, On the Trail of Anonymous. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Don Foster, a Shakespearean scholar and literary gumshoe. His new book is titled Author Unknown. Most of us can probably recite "Twas the Night Before Christmas" without missing more than a sugar plum or two. The famous poem was written by Clement Moore, but it turns out that there has long been another claim to the authorship of this poem, and Don Foster has most recently found himself on the front page of the New York Times in an article discussing the authorship of The Visit by St. Nicholas.
Well, Neil, if you had asked me a year ago who wrote The Night Before Christmas, I would have said Clement Clark Moore. Then one hot August afternoon, I received a phone call from a woman who identified herself as Mary Van Dusen, the great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Henry Livingston, a name that meant nothing to me. But Henry Livingston was, in fact, a sometime resident of my hometown and a soldier in the Revolutionary War. His family, as far back as his own children, have claimed that it was he, not Clement Clark Moore, who wrote The Night Before Christmas, and that an injustice has been done that was not yet corrected, and I was called in to investigate this problem.
Well, you're called in on a lot of things. What differentiated this from, you'll excuse, from crackpots?
Well, I get far more requests than I can usually assist with, and in this case I was inclined to politely decline, but Mary Van Dusen was quite persistent and read a bit of Moore's verse, a little bit of Henry Livingston, told me some of the story, and I was at the time writing my book, Author Unknown, and I thought, well, there might be a story here. As it turned out to be a much bigger story, more interesting story than I could have anticipated.
Where did the trail lead you?
Well, at first it led only to a dead end, a family legend. What do you do with that? And some verses by Livingston that sounded quite a bit like Night Before Christmas, and some verses by Moore that sounded nothing at all like The Night Before Christmas. There were stories of the two suspects' characters and lives. Henry Livingston was a jovial man who gave out gifts of wine to the Indians at Christmas time and who actually banqueted them. He was a poet for children. He sketched pictures for children and was an all-around well-loved man. Clement Clark Moore was a Bible scholar, a fine man, quite stodgy one, you might say, a little bit curmudgeonly, whose verse was of a much more severe and moralizing variety. But none of that finally constituted evidence. And after spending a couple of weeks on this problem, I was ready to bail on it. And when finally some additional documents rehooked my interest, and by the time that trail led to its conclusion, I found myself confronted with the unavoidable conclusion that Henry Livingston, in fact, was the author of this poem, and Clement Clark Moore an imposter.
And again, what was the straw that broke the... Let me mix my metaphors here. What was the straw that broke the smoking gun?
Well, it was a twisted trail that led me to the Poughkeepsie Journal, where much of Livingston's verse was published, and to the New York Historical Society Library, and hither and yon. The evidence for Livingston's authorship and the evidence against Moore's continued to mount. I guess what finally did it for me was the argument that Moore could not tell a lie. He was a Bible professor. He would not have accepted the credit for this poem if, in fact, he didn't write it. And what I found in looking at Moore's track record is not only that he would, but did, and in fact, at one point late in life, even took credit for another man's entire book.
Very few of us would know anything by Clement Moore, or allegedly by Clement Moore, other than 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, but at the time, I guess he was a regularly published writer?
Well, like many poets of the time, much of his poetry was published anonymously under the pseudonym L and various other, even though his name was Moore. And it was not poetry that was particularly engaging. Goes something like this: shame, shame, heart-rending thought, deep sinking stain that Britain's and Columbia's fair should deign, nay, strive their native beauties to enhance by arts first taught by prostitutes of France. That's more on cosmetics. And on almost every subject, he's quite severe in censuring the sinfulness of his fellow Americans. He wrote one prose tract denouncing Thomas Jefferson as a danger to the Commonwealth. Hmm. And one finds in Henry Livingston a very different spirit. In fact, the two men disagreed on almost every topic. Livingston was for public education. Moore was against it. Livingston favored the education of women. Moore opposed it. Livingston was opposed to slavery. Moore owned slaves. And so it makes Livingston the emotional favorite. And in this case, the evidence finally led to Livingston's door as well. And I think his family will be glad that his claim has finally been vindicated.
But when Moore made his claim, wasn't there anybody around to say, like Joe Klein, I did it?
Well, Livingston himself was long dead by the time this Night Before Christmas became associated with Moore's name. When it was associated with Clement Moore's name, he said nothing for many, many years. And meanwhile, the poem made him famous. In 1844, this is now almost 40 years after the poem was first written, almost 30 years after it was, well, a little more than 30 years after it was, after its first extant publication, he published The Night Before Christmas with his poems and quietly accepted credit for it.
Do you feel that you have now established the techniques that you have used as a science as precise as fingerprinting or as precise as DNA to absolutely identify the authors of certain works?
Neil, that's an interesting question. The comparison of linguistic evidence to DNA or fingerprint analysis is a common one, and I think not inappropriate, but there are limitations to any metaphor, and in this case, I would have to say that that scientific evidence of the kind that has proved itself again and again and again in fingerprint work and DNA work has to be considered more decisive. If we had Henry Livingston's fingerprints on an original manuscript of The Night Before Christmas, I don't think there would have to be any reason for a chapter on this controversy in my book.
Is there any area of literary controversy that you think is now ripe for this kind of analysis?
Well, in literary studies, there's some new controversy that arises every year, most recently one involving Ernest Hemingway. I'm content in future, I think, to let other literary scholars duke it out over these kinds of problems. I've got, I guess I'm feeling the desire to take a little bit of a break from text analysis and literary attribution to try my hand at some other kinds of endeavors.
Back to Shakespeare.
Well, back to Shakespeare and back to the classroom. I teach at Vassar. I have wonderful students there, and it's really the study of literary texts and the experience of the classroom that I entered literary studies for, and it's to that that I would like to return.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Don Foster's book is Author Unknown, On the Trail of Anonymous. He's a professor of English literature at Vassar College. Coming up, David Biancooley on the TV network's Election Nightmare. This is Fresh Air. Television's coverage of the 2000 presidential election turned out to be historic in several respects, but it will be best remembered for unprecedented flip-flops. All the networks called Florida wrong twice. TV critic David Biancooley watched all of the coverage with his bank of 11 TV sets and 11 VCRs running, and he has these comments.
Despite all the criticism the media has gotten with the way it called and miscalled Tuesday night's election, I think, by and large, the TV networks did a really good job. No, wait. Nah, I've changed my mind. Now I think what they did was really irresponsible and just another part of an obvious liberal media conspiracy. Nah, that's not right either. Look, if it's okay, can I just think about it some more and report back in a day or two? Or, to put it another way, what the hell happened there? Viewers who watched TV's election coverage Tuesday night were treated to, or tortured by, a roller coaster of emotions and conflicting information that was unprecedented in the history of televised politics. It was incredible, unforgettable television. We've never seen anything like it before, and hopefully we never will again. If you stopped watching before 10 p.m. Tuesday night, the clear inference was that Gore had it all but locked up. After 10, it was a nail-biter. After 2, it was time to get used to saying President Bush again. And after 3, who knew? Not the anchors, that's for sure. Florida went from undecided to Gore to undecided to Bush, then back to undecided. After the networks had taken it from Gore and given it to Bush, the prospect of taking it back again, which they eventually did, left them all shell-shocked and a little bit ashamed.
So, for those of you who went to bed or started going off to brush your teeth and come back and say, hello, what's this, Dan Rather? Well, I got to tell you, folks, A, I don't know. B, I don't know anybody who does know. What we do know...
Over on NBC, Tom Brokaw was equally uncertain.
Although I'm curious about why we're not seeing the governor yet. And we haven't seen Vice President Al Gore. Perhaps they're waiting for all the votes to be counted, all the I's to be dotted, all the T's to be crossed. Hmm. That would be something if the networks managed to blow it twice in one night.
They did. It was. Purely as a TV event, it was phenomenal. The stakes couldn't be higher. The extremes couldn't be sharper. The plot twists couldn't be more dramatic or unexpected. Whether you watched one network or flipped among several, you saw the same results, the same mistakes, and the same incredible reversals. The networks all blew it. No argument about that. But they blew it with the best of intentions, relying upon the best polling data and most sophisticated technology at their joint and individual disposal. The problem, with a national election hinging on a race as astoundingly close as the one in Florida, is that no prediction or exit poll could be accurate enough. Making any call, in retrospect, turned out to be the wrong call. Yet there wasn't any irresponsible rush to judgment or competitive zeal that led to those twin bad calls about Florida. All networks relied on the same polling organization, the Voter News Service, for their key sets of data. It's just that when the voting differential between the leading candidates dwindles from thousands to hundreds, no statistical model is that comfortably precise. Gore came within minutes of conceding prematurely early yesterday morning because the networks had just as prematurely anointed Bush the winner. When the numbers are as close as they were in Florida, the phrase too close to call should be taken by the networks as gospel. 4 years from now, because of what happened this time, I'm absolutely certain it will be. Well, okay, maybe not certain. Maybe the networks won't have learned anything at all. Can I get back to you on that?
David Bianculli is a TV critic for the New York Daily News. The executive producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher, Jessica Chu. Thanks for listening. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, a World War II veteran remembers an ill-fated attack on German soldiers that only he and two others in his platoon survived. Plus, two former POWs discuss their years of captivity in Hanoi and how they survived repeated torture. Join us for the next Fresh Air.